Pushkin.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Co.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I feel like we got to start with the archive intro. Do you want to do it?
What, the imagine?
Yeah.
Imagine a place in our world where the known things go. A corridor of time, bookshelves lined with old ballots, political campaign posters, and television ads. Step over a threshold to the Electoral College, as if it were an actual place. A university of knowledge about the past of American politics.
A place many people hate. It's not actually surprising. Application numbers are dropping this year. It's very staid old college, but yeah.
It used to be held in such high esteem, Electoral College.
Yeah.
And now its ratings have fallen.
Yeah. We're here to talk about the 2024 election in the context of history, but also in the context of these three last archive episodes we brought back from the archives. But I thought maybe to start, we could talk about how the last archive was kind of born out of an election. It kind of came from the 2016 election and the panic over fake news, alternative facts, the kind of Trump era epistemological crisis. And I guess now that we're 8 years past that moment, those concerns you had when you started the show, like, what do you think about them now? Like, how do they fit into this election cycle?
Yeah, so when we came up with the idea, you and I, for the last archive, it drew a lot from a course that I'd been teaching at the Harvard Law School on the history of evidence that looked at changing ideas and standards of proof in history, the law, science, and journalism since the Middle Ages, the kind of invention of trial by jury and the what historians call the cult of the fact. And that course maybe itself kind of came out of the sort of 2005 Stephen Colbert coining of truthiness. And the kind of panic in the first decade of the 21st century in the aftermath of the non-existent weapons of mass destruction and the idea that was pursued that somehow truth had died if the second Bush administration was willing to present to the American people essentially fabricated evidence to call for a war. But like any historian watching, they'd be like, what, did you not read the Pentagon Papers? What part of how the Vietnam War was also a war that depended on wholesale misrepresentation of conditions in the other, on other parts of the world to the American people. So the class was an attempt to kind of historicize a panic. Mm-hmm. And then the podcast was like, wait, it's the panic is even greater. And it's not like it's a misplaced panic, right? Like there are all kinds of reasons to think about the kind of crisis of truth. The Last Archive was kind of an attempt to say, all right, well, here's a way to calm down. Not that it's comforting, but like, let's try to historicize this and have fun thinking about the history of some of these ideas over the course of a century, at least, yeah. Not looking back 5 centuries or 6 centuries, but just looking in the last 100 years of American life, what has been the kind of trajectory of our shared ideas about evidence and proof and truth. And I remember like our big commitment was we didn't want to go after the usual suspects. Like we didn't want to have a podcast that attempted to prosecute Mark Zuckerberg or Donald Trump.
Did ultimately prosecute Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, I'd much rather prosecute Mark Zuckerberg. Yeah, what was the third big?
Postmodernism,
yeah.
Which also got a mention.
Yeah. So we didn't do the best job of steering clear of our easy villains.
But still, I mean, they are kind of mentioned on the side, but I do think it amounts to a more textured portrait of the thing.
Yeah, well, I hope so.
Well, one thing I was thinking about when I was listening back to Project X, it's like all about polling and forecasting. And I feel like if the Trump era is kind of like the mainstreaming of the panic about truthiness and the epistemological crisis, one of the first experiences of that for people, I think, was like, how could the polls be so wrong? Mm-hmm. That was like the same moment as Brexit. It's like, oh, we miscalled Brexit.
Right.
We really miscalled the 2016 election. And there was, you know, that Princeton professor who was so certain that it would be a Clinton victory that he was like, I'll eat an insect on television. And then he ate a cricket on CNN. It was like that. Everybody was eating crickets, basically, post-2016. A panic I now feel has sort of vanished. Like, you still hear this kind of like, oh, but like maybe Trump voters just don't answer polls. But when we don't really know, we might be still underrepresenting his support. But Project X feels like a kind of early history of some of that. We can predict the future with these new mm-hmm. machines. We don't even really need to run the election anymore. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could contextualize our poll crisis, if it still exists mm-hmm. in that historical context. Like, what is the promise of polling originally?
Yeah. I remember that in the 2015 primary season for the 2016 election, I did a lot of reporting for The New Yorker, which I don't, you know, I often just do research pieces from archives. And I had said, you know, I really want to kind of go out and report. So I went to, you know, rallies in New Hampshire during the New Hampshire primary, and I ended up going to both conventions. And one of the things I did is I went to one of the debates. And I remember there going into, I think it was like a CNN media tent or something. I mean, it's like a, those places, it's like a circus, like with all the kind of outbuildings that are popped up. And they were doing kind of live polling through the whole debate, sort of moment by moment. It was like, wait, this is everything that is wrong with our political culture and life. Like, it was a piranha-like frenzy on the American League. Tell us what you think. What do you think? What did you just say? Please tell us. I'm going to eat your own head. Like, it was just so manic and crazy and fruitless. And
wait, was this just people with like dials that they were like,
well, yeah, I don't know like what methods they were using. It was like a kind of like Instapoll web calling thing. And like it just defied every possible scientific method around public opinion surveying, which is a legitimate social science that has, you know, real standards of evidence. And it was completely unhinged. And I wrote a piece that year called Politics and the New Machine that was about how data science is replacing polling, because you couldn't just call landlines. People don't have landlines. The people who own landlines don't represent most of the population. You know, they tend to be really older, more rural, whiter. Like, it's just not, you can't get a good sample of the electorate. If you ever get a hold of like a young Hispanic man on a landline, you have to weight that person's opinion like 7,000 times, because that person has to represent like all young male Hispanics. Whereas if you talk to an old white woman, it's just her. Like, she just represents one person. So it's just a real field of distortion. So I wrote a piece about that because I just was really surprised at the incongruity of it all, that the worse polling got, like the less reliable polling seemed to be getting, the more our political arrangements were dependent on it. So that was the year that for the first time when Fox News, they hosted the first of the GOP primary debates. where they used polling, an average of, I think, four polls to decide who would stand where. And they had Trump
stand
in the middle. And it was really early on, and there had been very little coverage of anything, but Trump's name was better known. He's a guy who had had like a television show for years. And a lot of the most reputable polling agencies, I think, you know, Gallup and Pew and NBC, Wall Street Journal, refused to participate. They're like, you can't use our national polls that are like 290 days before the election to determine who gets the most, because where you stand on the stage determines how many questions you get and how much camera coverage you get. So you're just propping up a candidate. You know, you're just deciding what would get you the best audience. It's like one poll driving another poll, right? That's around when I was working on this piece. And, you know, the reputable polling people were like, yeah, it's unconscionable. Like, and then the polling organizations that did participate in that had the least reliable polls, right? Like they were the, you know, least principled ones. But so I know it's like a trendy thing to talk about the Overton window, but you do really kind of see, even with the history of polling, right? Polling's not gotten better since then.
Yeah.
And it's only made our politics messier and lousier. So I don't know. I mean, to go back to your question of historicizing it, one of the things that's different about, say, in 1948, when famously Gallup predicted that Dewey would win, and then the Chicago Tribune prints Dewey beats Truman, and then you see that this is a photograph of Truman holding up the paper with his giant, you know, grin. Polling really righted itself from that. There was a big investigation. I think the Social Sciences Council did an investigation. Gallup investigated itself. You know, there was a kind of reckoning with that because there were still in place institutional guardrails against like a real failure. But even that, like if you look at the history of that, Gallup had said, so Gallup, George Gallup, who's not an academic, but he opens this organization called the American Public Opinion Research Institute in Princeton, New Jersey, so that people will think it's part of Princeton University. So his address is Princeton. It's very canny. I mean, he has guys a PhD.
It's like Harvard, like Massachusetts. You're like, yeah, right. So far really? Away from the university. It is a town.
So let's not, you know, he had a PhD, like the guy was a real quantitative social scientist, but he's trying to sort of cloak his endeavor in the veneer of academic legitimacy when really he's a syndicated newspaper columnist. Like that's what he's kind of churning out. But in order to get newspapers to pick up his column, because the people are like, who cares what you say, like what the American people believe about that? Like we have reporters who go out on the street and they talk to people in pubs and they go to PTA meetings. We have like man on the street stories all the time. We know it. The people in our town, in our city, whatever our newspaper is, we know what they're reporting on, what they believe. We have reporters to do that work. Why would we take your column where like, I don't know, you've called people on the telephone. How many people have phones? It's nuts. So he did this big gimmicky thing, which is he said, you know what? Our opinion research is so good that we can ask people who they're going to vote for and we will successfully predict the next president. And that's when they started doing it. And he said all the time, like, this would be a really dangerous thing to do if we were doing this in order to guide candidates or, you know, drive funding of candidates. So this is just to demonstrate that our public opinion research is sound.
Yeah.
But then it was such a big hit. People love that horse race stuff that it kind of took on its own life. So it kind of then came to a crescendo of a crisis in 1948 when, like, his whole business model had then become like, no, my election predictions are where we're making money. Like, that's how we're gaining subscribers for my syndicated column. So you kind of see a kind of righting of that ship. But then this guy, Lindsay Rogers, writes this book right after that, or it comes out, you know, right after that. And he was like, I don't care whether the polling is accurate or inaccurate. It's bad for democracy. It's not how our democracy is supposed to work. It was surprising to me to discover how every critique that this political theorist Lindsay Rogers offered in this book called The Pollsters in 1948 really still applies. And it's a business model that's extremely successful. And there's not really a way you can say, and every generation has its, you know, grouch like me who comes along and says, wait, this stuff's actually really bad for our political culture. But it's like, well, white sugar is really bad, but all the food in the supermarket is laced with it. Like, it's not going to, like, saying that sugar is not so great for you is not going to stop it.
Yeah. It's funny because there was, did you listen to the Nate Cohn interview recently where he talks about finding a historical precedent for the 2024 election? And the one he finds is 1948, because Truman suffered from high inflation, high prices, and had actually successfully managed them in the lead up to the election. Mm-hmm.
But a thing that's like not mentioned in his account is that after 1948, there's a huge crisis.
That's funny.
And then that ties into the Project X thing, where it's like the reason they don't share the UNIVAC prediction is because they're like, polls were so off in 48,
right,
we can't come out with this landslide prediction early in the evening because just who knows.
Right.
But I guess like from the episode perspective, I mean, you talk about responsible polling, people who understand what the limitations of polling actually are, what the appropriate use of it is. It seems like it's a media demand or like a voter demand. People want to know how things are going to turn out, or even like a Wall Street demand. People want to be able to project forward. Like there's already all this attention given to predicting the next election because it's going to bear on how the markets do.
Right.
It has a lot to do with futures in an economic sense and also in a kind of like entertainment sense.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Project X version of this has all of those things. It's got the sort of like, we're making a show out of projections.
Right.
But it also has the behind-the-scenes blurring of the line between how the campaign is being run, which is Rosser Reeves making the ad spots based on the Gallup polling about what are people most concerned with. You know, like, my Mamie gets after me about high prices, the Dwight Eisenhower thing. Is that the moment that those things really come together, or is it like the 30s Campaigns Inc. moment? Or
I don't know. I think it really, I think the 1952 story remains deeply resonant because it's kind of the Super Bowlification of election night. So, you know, when we talk to Ira Chinoy and his work, you know, he kind of relays these tremendously interesting stories about early technologies of reporting results, like
the New York Times building.
Yeah, we'll have the New York Times building, the, you know, the, that will light up red if it's going this way and green if it's going that way.
It's a total one if by land, they have two this, if by
like,
sea
yeah,
thing.
Like, we'll blink, you know, we'll blink fast if the Democrats are ahead. And, like, just crazy. Like, it's lighthouses and it's, no one really knows. And they're kind of out in the street. Only in the city maybe you would get, like, any kind of updates.
Yeah.
But in 1952, they do all this elaborate setting up of cables, right? Like they have the studio and that's got all these reports going on, and they have this map, and you know, Cronkite's gonna go to the map, and then they have the guy with the UNIVAC, the fake UNIVAC, and then there's also the real UNIVAC, and they have people are calling in with precinct results, and they're trying to do tabulation, and they have punch cards, and it's a whole sort of fun circus to watch, and the clock is in the background, and we'll have new results at the top of the hour, and they're trying desperately to make people watch television instead of listen to the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And there's very little to report. They're just not going to have the results until the morning, but they're trying to, you know, what we call must-watch television, right? And they're really pretty successful. People are like, well, this is fun. I mean, what else are you going to do? It's like a Tuesday night in November.
Sit there anxiously.
It's probably cold outside much of the country. Like, it's, you know, it's a civic lesson for your kids. It is pretty interesting. Like, what are all these machines? The TV's brand new. It's exciting that you even have one. And, oh, you, it's like you're in the war room at the White House. Like, it's like you're part of a campaign. You're wrapped into the drama of it all, and there's really nothing else quite like it, and it's really successful for them, their Project X. And then there's a kind of a level raising, like you have to up your game every 4 years, you have to come up with a more exciting election.
We have to invent Wolf Blitzer, the man.
So like you know, and if then I write about when the Simulmatics company is hired to go do election prediction in 1960 by CBS. And it's just mayhem. No one knows how to program the mainframes. There's all these women trying to type in, the, you know, who are the computers trying to type in the results that are coming in by phone, and people are falling down, tripping over the cables. And it's a comedy of errors, but yeah, it's still great television. And it also obscures, you know, the reality of like knocking on doors and driving people to the polls and what election day is really about. That's why I'm making the case that that's 1952 Project X is more resonant than ever before, is because what happened in 2020, remember, it was the pandemic. Most people did not want to go to the polls and wait in those lines or go indoors. And, you know, the best news organizations said every once in a while, like Orson Welles saying in 1938 at War of the Worlds, we don't actually, this is not real. You know, and they would say, like, we won't really know the results tonight because mail-in ballots and absentee ballots are not going to be counted over to the next few days. And right now, it really looks like, you know, Republicans are winning all over the country and Trump's going to win enough electoral votes. But this is a red mirage. It's, you know, most people expect this to change in the coming days or even weeks as the late coming votes are counted. But, you know, they said that like maybe once every 2 hours. And meanwhile, except for the like 30 seconds every 2 hours that they're pointing out that their results are completely useless and meaningless, like really, truly meaningless, the most meaningless election night results probably ever in American history. They're selling the whole thing to keep their audience as if they have to watch second by second because the election is about to be called. And then they start calling it. And so, I mean, this is where, like, one can exert a lot of sympathy for Americans who believe the election was stolen because they watched that coverage. Yeah. And look, we watched, you know, we watched the John King. He had the panels and the thing flipped and then the color turned. And then we looked like this state was going this way in Arizona and Michigan, Pennsylvania. And then, you know, I went to bed and then they're like, no, we don't know. No, and then they've called it for Biden. No, that was stolen. Like, I'm so, like, I know it's this just an incredible amount of perfidy in terms of the planning up to the election that Trump knew he was going to lose, that his supporters expected, you know, his inside like team knew he was going to lose. And they came up with these cockamamie plans to pursue a contest of the results. They knew in advance, like I don't mean to diminish the nefariousness of their planning, but in terms of, well, people being willing to believe it when he said the election was stolen. No one has ever held, I'm not talking about the pollsters, but the television producers accountable for what happened that night. You know, why not say, and you don't even hear this now, and there's a ton of mail-in, we would expect a lot of mail-in voting in November. We'd also, I think, expect really low turnouts in a lot of places that I have not, couldn't really, would be really hard to account for with your polling results. And we are not going to hear on election night people saying, we've decided tonight that we are going to re-examine the results of the 2020 election and investigate our own coverage as a public service to the American voter and explain, one, the ways in which we as a news organization contributed to the chaos in American political life over the last 4 years. We'll be getting back to you tomorrow night. We'll have full coverage of amended election results. But for tonight, we're going to set that aside and we're going to do what we think is right. Maybe that would be bad television. I think that'd be awesome television.
Yeah.
But I think that reckoning and accountability is genuinely required. Like, I just can't even picture, like, Jake Tapper or whoever. Like, and I don't, these are the best people, right? Like, saying, we really screwed up. Like, we are in big part responsible. It's just much easier to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, they're working within the framework that's established in 52, which is received and can't be changed, so they're not going to question it. I totally buy that the election night coverage contributed to this, but it does seem to me like over the last decade, you have so many crazy lies that are just convenient lies that people just like take up and believe just because
they, you know. No, I mean, in the campaign, you know, the false electors that like there's... Yeah. I thought about this a lot when I was asked to write a review of the January 6th report from the House Select Committee.
You're like, could have been more fun. Could have been a little more entertaining. Right.
Like, it was like, I don't know, 1,500 pages long. You know, I read every word of it and then I wrote this piece. But I was, and it's in many ways, you know, an excellent report. And it served basically as the bill of indictment for the federal prosecution of Trump and other conspirators. And so really meaningful kind of bill of indictment against Trump. But it is laser focused on Trump. And it is a list of really indictable allegations about Trump. And, you know, that was a decision that the committee made, you know, I think partly to accommodate, largely to accommodate Liz Cheney, who did not want to be indicting other Republicans aside from Trump, and who did not want to lose sight of Trump as the leader of the conspiracy. But among the things that that committee had done in its hearings, which I think are barely in the public eye at all, was investigate the role of the media. And there was another investigation into social media. And none of that stuff is in the report. And so you read that report and you're just like, wow, single-handedly, Trump and, you know, the occasional like Giuliani, Sidney Powell, other lunatic, you see their villainy, their outright criminality. Could there have been like three paragraphs about, you know, network and cable television on election night and how it made it harder to undo that lie? Because you do kind of puzzle over, all right, there were 61 different court cases and Trump lost 60 of them. And the one that he won had no consequences in terms of a recount. Like, there's so many ways in which there's just such abundant evidence that strikes down, you know, the criminal misrepresentations and lies of Trump and his lackeys. Remember, like, people, members of the Republican Party still have not essentially conceded the election to Biden and were, you know, very close to the next election. So, and you're like, well, why? They clearly don't want to disappoint their followers. They think their constituents believe this, so they need to not defy their constituents. But why would their constituents keep believing this? It's like been disproven in every possible forum where we arbitrate truth. And like just among the places where we might consider asking for some accountability would be news organizations.
Especially because in 2016, that is what happened with social media. There was like an attempt at that kind of reckoning. Right. And you don't really see any of that in 2020. It is interesting to think about Project X as like a comparison for the 2020 election. I was thinking about framing it as there are like two separate epistemological crises. 2016 election, we no longer can predict the future because we just don't understand what's happening anymore. Mm-hmm. And then 2020, we lose faith in elections. Mm-hmm. But I think it's compelling, the idea that they are linked in this way. I do wonder, though, to what extent do you think voters earnestly believe the election was stolen? And do you think it's going to have an impact in 2024? Beyond how Trump campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm not a, you know, inside the Beltway DC reporter. I would love to talk to someone who does that kind of work, you know, like a Susan Glasser from The New Yorker or Dan Baltz from The Washington Post, and say, are people preparing for the election denialism? Like, what is in place? Not only preparing for, you know, assuring election integrity, I feel like we'd, you know, the states and down to the municipal and town level actually do have a ton of that stuff in place. Like, that's why the 2020 election actually went so well, as in terms of the election proceeding well and the counting is really reliable reporting of results. And, you know, any audits were, you know, revealed just really tremendously impressive accuracy with the counting. So I'm not worried about the election results. But everybody should be worried about the election denialism that is likely coming. And I still think, honestly, when we talk about polling, that, you know, if we had a national popular vote, polling would be more reliable than it is. You know, when people do those national polls, they just don't talk about the electoral college. So there's like so many ways in which we are not positioned to know who is going to win an election. And this is likely to be an extremely close election. I don't think that we can expect anything other than extremely close elections at the presidential and national level anytime soon. And surely the Trump campaign is thinking of all kinds of ways to undermine the outcome of the election if Trump loses, which he's, you know, pretty likely to do. He's pretty likely to have been convicted of a felony by then, which is at least expected to cut some dent in his support among independents, at least. So I'm sure they have a really elaborate plan in place for exactly what to do. And I don't know, I think it's really worrying.
Do you remember, so one of the episodes that we've rerun is Hush Rush, which is the Rush Limbaugh, Al Franken episode. And I was remembering when I listened back to it that one of the things we read for that but then didn't include in the episode was that David Posen, the Columbia law scholars, that awesome article, Transparency's Ideological Drift. And one of the claims in that essay that I had never seen before, and it really stuck with me, is we think of transparency laws like the progressive era and the 60s and 70s as these like super liberal progressive reforms. But then actually they have these right-wing functions when you like FOIA the EPA to death or whatever. Mm-hmm. But another way that they contribute to dysfunction in government is when you have everything broadcast on C-SPAN, everything is accessible to lobbyists and private interests especially, but like really just to everybody, you have to keep acting as if the things you do as campaign strategies or the things you think your constituents want from you are like exactly how you believe and behave, and you like refuse to make any kind of compromises. And that, I think it speaks to that idea of we might have plenty of Congress people who don't for a second believe that the election was stolen, mm-hmm. but they have to act as if, because this is one of the consequences of the, mm-hmm. like, everything's a culture war because you can see everything behind mm-hmm. the scenes. Mm-hmm. Do you think a way of answering the kind of crisis in the media is to take some of the work of governing offline, or would that just create a whole other raft of problems?
I mean, I think there is a lot offline, but we are kind of offered the illusion that we can see it all. So you hear all the time, if you know anybody involved in politics or, you know, members of Congress, that yeah. like, oh yeah, these guys who still say that publicly that Trump won the election, privately, they'll laugh and laugh and laugh at him. And like, obviously, he totally lost. The guy's a complete fraud. And they want you to kind of forgive them privately, to allow them to kind of make amends by being honest with you, you know, that they can kind of feel like they're acting in good faith because really, you know, it's like a kind of weird penance I've heard this multiple times, like to kind of confess and try to like almost like erase your public persona by insisting.
It's like, we all know that's not
yeah.
real.
Yeah.
Guys.
Like to kind of have a camaraderie around that privately. And it's incredibly contemptible, right? Like you can think of more sinister ways to act as a politician, like to vote for a war that, you know, to cast your vote in Congress to declare a war when you don't believe in it, or to withhold funding for something that is a crucial kind of humanitarian aid in order to gain some, you know, really self-serving pork for your state, or like things that kind of compromises that people make surely all the time that largely involve money. And yeah, you can think of worse things, but it's a pretty short list.
Yeah. It's just like you have this performance personality, or there's this like unreality to the way you behave, and everybody accepts it, but then it's like the only way you're behaving in public, so it becomes real, which is this like reality TV phenomenon, mm-hmm. which is very Trumpy.
But is it Trumpy? Because I think progressives do a whole version of that. Like, the progressives are really Trumpy too. Like, that's the difference between 2016 and 2024, right? The American political style across the board imitates Trump.
Yeah, but that is like part of the premise of The Last Archive, is that this thing that appears to have taken this thing that like you might think Trump has caused, mm-hmm. is actually just like he's the man for the moment, because right. he fits all of the structures we have in place, which are these varying degrees of unreality and like
right,
fantasies
right,
we have about the
but
way politics
why,
work.
You know, when you look at Rush Limbaugh and then you look at Al Franken, you're like, oh, I really wish Franken were significantly different. And no, he's not. He's different.
Not nearly as
he's
bad.
He's different.
Yeah.
You know, he's not nearly as bad. But there's, you know, a real leaning in that direction of, you know, let me kick you in the crotch.
Or like, just like the entertainment, like yeah. politics is entertainment, yeah. which is the CBS election night thing too.
Yeah.
Well, I guess part of the point of this conversation is to find precedents for the 2024 election, mm-hmm. which is kind of funny because I feel like a lot of the narrative of this election is that it's totally unprecedented. Mm-hmm. You know, like Trump having so many criminal cases, mm-hmm. Biden's age, like two candidates who are historically old. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe that's a place to start in trying to think about how you historicize these things that feel like they come out of nowhere, or mm-hmm. like they've never happened before. So like, maybe to begin with the age question, and we don't need to think about this in terms of like, should Biden be the nominee for the Democratic Party, but more just like, how did we get to this place where we have two historically old candidates? And the bigger picture thing behind that, the gerontocracy, mm-hmm. where does that come from?
Right.
What does it mean for democracy?
Right. So one of the reasons that I wanted to do The Last Archive in the first place is because, as a historian, the rhetoric of the unprecedented development was really driving me crazy, like, by the time we started. And I guess I really noticed that after Bush v. Gore in 2000, mm-hmm. which, you know, was unprecedented. There's a kind of 1876 moment you could point to. But it became a very lazy journalistic move for journalists writing about pretty much anything in American politics to call their Rolodex American presidential historians, right? Which is like five people. That really, like, you'd see David Gergen and Michael Beschloss and Doris Kearns Goodwin in pretty much every story, commenting on whether this, whatever it was unprecedented. And, like, it's a stupid question, is the thing. And there's no answer that can be satisfying, because every answer reduces the past to, you know, like an ice cube tray, and, like, you pop out an ice cube. This one would be good with this drink. Like, it just, it's like a meaningless thing. So, you know, when the 2008 financial crisis happened, I remember, because then, I would start getting these calls, like, is this financial crisis unprecedented? And, you know, how does it compare to 1931, 1932? And what are you talking about? There's, like, nothing, there's nothing in common between 2008 and 1931, 1932. Like, we're not eating our shoes. This is a completely different set of problems with finance and globalism and, like, and chicanery among financiers. Like,
that's the argument that it is unprecedented, that, like, everything is new because everything is a totally different set of context.
Yeah, so there are always, you could always call upon, you say, well, it would actually be really quite interesting to compare 2008 to 1932, but it's an act of extended comparison. There are some things that are similar. And one of the things that, as a historian, you're interested in doing is measuring the distance between two points and then trying to figure out what's the engine that drives you from point A to point B. You know, is it changes in the economy? Is it U.S. foreign policy? Is it changing technology? Is it the circulation of goods due to new transportation infrastructure? Like, there are a lot of interesting questions you could ask, but you can't ask those questions and answer them in, you know, a 3-minute phone call with a reporter or popping up on MSNBC or something. Like, it's very hard to offer up an account of the relationship between the past and the present to the media as it is currently configured. So the past is really flattened. It's, like, available for the occasional bon mot. Oh, FDR once said, you know, this reminds me of something that Kennedy did. Like, what? Like, as the history, especially because everything becomes narrowed to presidential action. So all those accounts fall prey to what historians call presidentialism, right? Just inflating the presidency as the sole mover of all events in the United States. Like, oh, the economy's down. Well, it's President Biden. Like, what the hell did he do? I don't know. Like, it's a weird thing. But since the go-to people among historians are these kind of celebrity presidential biographers, it's not their fault that they're getting the phone calls, and their answer is going to involve something that a president said or a president did. And so those answers are just really not going to be illuminating, and they're going to distort Americans' perception of how change happens. There's nothing that's ever structural. Nothing's really driven by economic forces or technological forces. Everything is somehow driven from the White House. And it corrupts our sense of our own capacity as voters and as citizens to act, mm-hmm. right? Or as parents or as, you know, children or as school principals or whatever. Like, somehow everything's nationalized and partisanized, so that, like, is this ever precedented as that go-to? Or even, like, you know, the swine flu panic or, you know, the coronavirus. Like, everything has to kind of answer that question. And it sort of drove me crazy because, I don't know, like, it just seems like would you call up a chemist and say, can we turn out, steel into gold? Like, it just doesn't, it's like, that's not how chemistry works. Like, that's alchemy. Like, that just doesn't, it defies the method of being a chemist. Why would you ask me such a question?
Because they want, like, unprecedented is another way of saying newsworthy.
Yeah.
Which is then, like, I have a peg. This has never happened before.
I have a peg. This has never happened before. Like, so I get it. And I'm like, I do, there's, I mean, like, I get why a journalist would want to do that. But as a historian, there is a lot to be learned from the past. So you kind of want to say, like, wait, but yeah, actually, there's something. And let me tell you about the election of 1876. It's really different from this, but here's how that went. So anytime I was asked to do something as a historian, like write an essay or whatever about something in the present, there had to be a way that something in the past illuminates it, but then to try to tell that story in a way that doesn't reduce the past to the prologue to the present. Like everything is somehow explained by the past. And therefore, we should either, like, get really worried or not worry at all.
Yeah.
Like, people want to talk about the lack of civility in Congress. Remember that guy who screamed out, "You lie," to Obama during the State of the Union? And then there was all, like, everybody would call this historian at Yale, Joanne Freeman, who'd written about the fisticuffs on the floor of Congress,
like Sumner getting canned
in the 1850s and 1840s. And it was like, somehow, sure, that's important history. We should know that. But does it mitigate the cruelty and just vulgarity of members of Congress today? Does it make us sleep easier that people were crap in the past? I don't know. Like, what's the, I don't even understand what that is meant to offer. Like, as a citizen, I just actually want my members of Congress to be better. I get the fact that people bashed each other over the head in 1856 doesn't actually make me think it's okay to do it today.
Well, it is interesting to think about this in the context of the conversation we're having around polling, though, insofar as they're both entertainment-oriented products that are sort of like newsy in a way, but they're also about conveying a sense of security. Like, if something is precedented, if it's happened before, we've seen this before, we know everything's going to be okay in the future. Same if you think you can predict what the future is going to be. So there is this way in which they both serve to manage anxiety
about
change.
But you know what it also did? It diminished the threat that was Trump, because I don't know if you can remember this, but I have really strong memories.
Like, oh,
people trying to come with, like, he's like 30% Goldwater, 40% Nixon, and the other 30% is George Wallace. Or, you know, he's 50% P.T. Barnum and 50% Charles Lindbergh. And you'd be like, what? Like, yes, there are frauds and tycoons and showmen and wannabe dictators in the American past, but wait, this guy is looking like he's going to win. Like, this guy has a huge following. You know, and I don't place myself outside of, like, diminishing what that was or what his presidency might do or his likelihood of getting elected. But it really was a disservice to people's ability to understand him. And, like, as a voter, I would say, to me, one of the great mistakes of that the 2015-2016 moment was the Democratic Party deciding to defer to Hillary Clinton, to drum Bernie Sanders off of all possible stages and to discourage anyone else from running. Elizabeth Warren wanted to run, right?
Yeah, I totally agree.
I would have so loved to see, okay, they have a lot of people lining up, these Republicans, and have the Democrats say to themselves, let's see who's out there. Like, why Hillary Clinton, who was a terrible candidate and a terrible candidate to put off against who became the eventual nominee. But, like, that, to your question of, like, how do we get here to 2024 with this gerontocracy, from the Democratic point of view, you see that real lack of faith in the people's ability to discriminate and choose the best candidate, the party will anoint Hillary Clinton, or the party will, say, of course, Joe Biden is going to run. Everyone has to agree not to contest that, not to even publicly challenge it, but certainly not to run against him or to give money to someone who might run against him. It's completely anti-democratic with a lowercase d. And the fact that the Democratic Party is allegedly running as the party of democracy when they can't actually even tolerate a competition for the party's nomination for president is appalling. But I think that risk aversion is somewhat, I think, as you're kind of suggesting, tied to that fetish around the unprecedented, like, oh, well, because this is the most important election that's ever happened, Hillary Clinton must be our candidate. She's, you know, or whatever, like that somehow the nature of the rig, you have to be willing to lose. And yeah, if you don't trust the voters or the voters in your own party, then you're not doing your job. I think the reasons that the what looks like, as the moment we're talking, that Trump and Biden will be the major party nominees. I think the reasons for their elevation to those positions are different. But, I mean, they're both representations of many political failures, a chain of political failures, but the failures are different along the way.
We were talking last night about the calls for an open convention from people who are concerned about Biden's age. And it's kind of a lovely fantasy in some sense, but one of the big concerns I have about that is, like, do you really trust the Democratic Party to pick a candidate that meaningfully represents what the voting base would want? And it seems like 2016 is a good example of why you might be suspicious that that's actually going to yield a result that they would be happy with.
But it's not unlike, there's currently a pretty major effort on the part of Republicans of the kind of Greg Abbott, Ted Cruz, Rick Santorum arm of the party to get enough state legislatures to call for a second constitutional convention, that there would be one. And that's been going on for a number of years, and they're getting closer year by year. And it has been the position of the left since the 1980s to oppose such a convention on the theory that it would lead to results that liberals and progressives would not like. And you can keep doing that, but you can't then also call yourself the party of democracy. And if there's going to be a convention, maybe you should prepare for it and actually have a plan and an agenda and a proposal for what the rules of such a convention would be, and have a wish list and have a platform, start thinking about delegates, like maybe start initiating smaller convention-like meetings that involve not just the party elites, but actual voters. So a reason that you don't have a lot of faith in a Democratic National Convention choosing a candidate that you would be happy with is you've probably never been a participant in any kind of a convention of any kind. Whereas historically, you know, state constitutional conventions were held all the time. Constitution-like conventions held in towns and cities for all kinds of activities. It was like the main mode other than voting. People participated as citizens, and sometimes they're called citizen assemblies. But that very act of, like, gathering together with a bunch of random people to kind of make a decision about something, that's what polling replaced. So we now have this, like, weird now it's like tech-driven thing. Instead of getting together at the town library, you know, we're talking here in Vermont where there still are town meetings, but a lot of the town meetings have become Zoom meetings. Like, that was the kind of consequence of COVID and also of diminishing attendance at town meetings. But we just don't, we're not in the habit of sitting in a room and arguing things out, building a coalition, arriving at some kind of decision, accepting that nobody gets what they want, that compromise is important. And so no one trusts the convention any more than they trust elections. I think people trust conventions a lot less because they just don't even know what that means. Like, there has not been a state constitutional convention in the United States since 1986 was Rhode Island. Like, it was voted on in 1984 as a ballot initiative.
Why was that a ballot initiative for them?
So they have a regular, there are a number of, I think it's maybe 10 states that it's in their constitution that the voters will be asked at a regular interval, would you like to hold a convention? So I think Rhode Island's is every 10 years. So there were some of these votes in 2022. There are going to be some in 2024. Voters keep saying no because they just don't trust conventions anymore. Because no one even really knows what that means. Well, how would you pick delegates and how that happens? But, like, a convention, I would love to attend a convention, like actually in a meaningful way to participate in one. But it's one of the biggest holes in our system of representative government because it's a major, historically, it's like a major way that Americans involve themselves in political decision-making. You know, not everyone's going to run for the legislature. And first polling and now, like, social media posting is somehow, right? Like,
our civic engagement.
Yeah. And so I get that, not trusting. Like, or if you were a Republican and they said, you know, we're going to have an open convention because Trump's in jail now or whatever, people would really freak out. It's not on either party. Like, it's across the board. People don't trust the idea of letting the people decide about something.
There was, I mean, this connects to the Posen thing also, because there's that, okay, sure, you can put everything about Congress, everything Congress does is now on television. But like, who's actually watching? It's mm-hmm. lobbyists, it's private interest groups, the mm-hmm. people who actually have the time, which most of us don't. And it reminds me of two moments in the episodes that we just reran. In Hush Rush, there's the Rush Limbaugh quote, something to the effect of, if you listen to me, you never have to read another newspaper, mm-hmm. never yeah. have to read another magazine. Yeah. I do it for you. And best of all, I tell you what to think about these very complicated issues. And then there's the Eisenhower ad from the 56 election that we love so much, that we almost made the avatar of The Last Archive, that little cartoon guy mm-hmm. who's surrounded by all his voices.
How do I know what the facts yeah, are?
High prices, low prices, unemployment, like full employment. Wait, stop. I read the papers and the magazines, like, you know, but who's right? What's right?
Yeah.
How can I tell?
Yeah.
That kind of increasing complexity, the like daily burden of democracy mm-hmm. is heavier every day because mm-hmm. it's a more and more complicated world. And I mean,
is it though? No, it's just a more and more nationalized political conversation.
You don't think
so? I think like, if you were just, do you participate like in your neighborhood, in a neighborhood council, or in your borough in New York, in borough meetings? Like if you were doing those things, it wouldn't actually be that hard to keep up with what you needed to know. Like, well, there's a new budget line about our public library and this branch, you know, like it's just, most of us completely abandoned our responsibility to the civic institutions that are part of our local lives.
No, well, we do that. And it is like, we want to reroute traffic on this street. Maybe, yes, that is still simple in a way that it was before. Although I do think, I mean, especially with neighborhood determinations and building mm-hmm. and things like that, there's environmental reviews. Like my dad is on on the conservation committee, I think it's called, for the suburb where my parents live. Yeah. And those are like, they have to do these really intensive reviews. Yeah. So like in some way, I actually do think those things are more complicated now than they were before. But I guess I'm talking more about the, you know, our season 2, episode 5 and 6 moon landing argument of like, there's just stuff now that you could not possibly understand on your own, mm-hmm. both geopolitically and technologically, mm-hmm. the scale of the problems we face, or at least the scale of the problems we can now comprehend that perhaps we could not before, mm-hmm. does feel vaster to
me. But if you really believe that, then why does everybody get to vote?
Because I do still believe in people's capacity to understand these mm-hmm. things. I'm just saying I think it takes more work. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the problems is you get all these shortcuts from doing the work. Mm-hmm. And some of them can be trusted and others of them can't. Mm-hmm. But maybe there ultimately is no real substitution mm-hmm. for like taking the time to think hard about these issues. Mm-hmm. And we've all just gotten comfortable with substitutions that we shouldn't be comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that the sense though of helplessness around, do I even know enough to figure out how to vote here in this, you know, for the Senate seat in my state, is exacerbated by just a tremendous deterioration of support for local news organizations, which means that the kind of daily reporting about what's going on in your town, your neighborhood, your state, at your state house, is really hard to find. And it's really hard. It's hard to figure out who's going to pay for that. So, you know, in the absence of that local news coverage, people turn to the drama of the national news coverage and they get kind of radicalized by their news sources. And, you know, we can think of all kinds of problems that fall from that. But I don't think until we solve the problem of local news, we can solve those larger problems.
Yeah. Something that's interesting about 2024 is it's the biggest election year in history. You know, roughly 4 billion people are going to go to the polls this year. That's like about half the global population who are going to participate in self-determination. Mm-hmm. That's an incredible thing. Mm-hmm. But then there's this sad undercurrent to that, which is that in so many of these elections, there's this, you know, cliched thing that's kind of true, that democracy is on the ballot. And I guess it brings me to this question about 2016 and the panic around democratic norms. How do you actually promote a democratic cast of mind, which we've like talked about in the radio episodes too? What is your answer to that? How do we inculcate in voters the spirit of democracy, mm-hmm. the tolerance for the complexity and mm-hmm. the daily work of it?
I think a lot of really smart people have thought about that, like that the new Ziblatt and Levitsky book on the tyranny of the minority really kind of spells out what the stakes are. But there have been some great efforts made at thinking through what the solutions are, too. So one of my favorites is the report that the American Academy of Arts and Sciences put out several years ago, after like a multi-year study involving, you know, hundreds of people all over the country. It was led by Daniel Allen, political theorist at Harvard. And among their recommendations were these kind of small steps, like the kind of obvious thing, like, oh, Election Day should be a national holiday. It should be held on Veterans Day. It would honor veterans to do so. Then just sort of be kind of, instead of election night being a television and social media spectacle, you could have the day itself as a kind of July 4th celebration of the act of voting and the great privilege that that is. And people wouldn't have to go to work and, you know, the sort of federal holiday piece of it. And so it was, for instance, really discouraging to me personally when Biden's big move was to make Juneteenth a federal holiday. It was like, okay, you could have, you know, like Election there was day, another, yeah. That was like, this is a kind of real bipartisan project. Like there's not, it like just, there's really not a ton of objection to that. And the only objection is it wouldn't make it possible for more people to vote. So it's hard to state that as an objection publicly. You know, there should be a year or two of mandatory national service that could be civil or military that would bring together people, you know, serve with people from all over the country, and it would sort of mix Americans up more. Like things like that, that just seem, they seem kind of doable. You know, forgiving student debt was always going to be challenging to enforce, to implement, to get through, to defend on budgetary grounds. But the national service, which would have also provided funds for students to go to college, right? Like in recompense of that, there, you know, this just like a much better idea and actually achieves in terms of support for college education for people that can't afford it is a much better solution. Because it meets all these other civic goals, whereas the forgiving student debt is like a become a really bad, you know, partisan hot potato. Like, so it's frustrating to see these really good ideas not having been quite taken up yet. But that doesn't mean there aren't really good ideas out there. So in terms of how to implement those things or why they haven't been implemented, because they're, you know, they've been supported by so many different people. I sadly think you have to look at who's making money off of not implementing that stuff.
Mm.
If I think about 2024 as the product of a series of political failures, and you know, have made the case for media accountability for some of those failures, I really just think historically, so much of the blame is going to be placed on the Republicans in the Senate who voted against convicting Trump of impeachment in the second of impeachment after the January 6th insurrection. That was just a complete abdication of their constitutional duty as members of the Senate. It was a completely clear-cut case. And among the arguments that you now see, I mean, for one thing, you know, Mitch McConnell famously said, oh, you know, he's subject to criminal indictment and prosecution, and that's the way this should happen.
Now the argument is immunity.
And now the argument is he's immune from criminal prosecution. But for another, you know, when you read memoirs of people like Mitt Romney or Liz Cheney, you learn that a lot of those members of the Senate who voted against conviction did so because they had been subject to threats of violence against their wives and young children. And as terrifying as that is, and as terrible as that is as itself, as, you know, the symptom of the pathology of our politics, you are a member of the Senate, and your obligation is to cast the correct vote. And it is like a trial by jury. It is a trial by jury. It is our constitutional trial by jury. And you can't choose to vote not to convict out of fear. And stand by that. And I mean, I just think when we think about all the things, all the kinds of compromises to what is true and what is not true, how do people know what is true? How are we to know who to believe? At the end of the day, those guys, the guys who voted not to convict Trump in the Senate, I think bear the heaviest burden for, you know, the near catastrophe that is our current political culture.
Yeah. To wrap up, we've talked about a lot of sort of bad habits of American democracy. And I think one of them is this idea that the election is all that matters. And it's hard to escape that idea in an election year. And obviously it is an extremely important thing, but it's not the only thing. Mm-hmm. If you were to come up with three rules for keeping your head during an election year, what would they be?
Yeah, I think that the rules that I live by are just like completely unpalatable to most people. Like, never, ever go on social media. Just refuse to participate in it. It is bad for the human condition. I've just never heard a really powerful defense of social media as being good for you psychologically, emotionally, politically, culturally. So that's me, though. I can't, like, that's not a prescription. People don't live that way. Like, that's just my own quirkiness. So, But I think come up with some decision for yourself about what amount of that or what exposure to that or what participation in that seems to you defensible. And where does it cross the line? This was good. I feel good about this. This is how I learn about new music. This is how I stay in touch with these people. Whatever it is, that's good. But I think to think really carefully about where to draw the line yourself between what's good for you politically and not just good for you, good for your community, for the polity to which you belong, good for our political culture. I mean, more people make more responsible decisions about that. Things would be better. I mean, you know, going to the neighborhood council meetings, getting involved in the local convening of whatever kind of convening it is. You know, the suggestion, like, join a knitting group. Like, honestly, like, figure out a way to meet with other people in each other's houses and talk about what you're going to do next. Like, are we going to knit a sweater? Are we going to work on a hat next time? Like, just
what about a massive campaign flag?
Just disagree with people about something with very low stakes and accept how compromises work. And, like, just kind of exercise those muscles around, like, being with a group of people that are not your own family and not your workmates, in which you make some decisions that, like, don't really matter. You know, or a book club or whatever, like, get together, you know, talk about the podcast. It doesn't really matter what you do, so long as you, like, meet with other people, like, in person and make decisions that involve compromises. Like, that's just a good place to be in terms of figuring out, like, what do you actually believe in terms of, like, if people get together and decide things together and consent to them as a group, was that a good outcome? I think the reason people are so vulnerable to authoritarianism is they have very little experience of civic participation any longer. Or, you know, it's the declining church membership, right? Like, if you were going to your church board meetings all the time, and many people do, but many people don't, you'd have a model for, like, yeah, actually, when we get together with a bunch of other people and we argue it out, like, we usually come up with a good out. Like, you have to find some way to have to be a part of your life.
Yeah, it goes to the, like, at the end of the Epiphany episode, when you're talking to Steve Chapin, and he reads that passage from the Social History of Truth.
Yeah.
Where knowledge is a collective good.
Yeah.
This kind of, it like, bears on our social relationships. It bears on trusting people. And to trust somebody, you have to know them, not just in the way you might know someone at a distance online.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, there has to be a way. It's not that hard to put that back into your life if you had it once, or to find it if you don't have it yet.
Third rule.
Oh, my third rule is, it's like, actually expose yourself to ideas that you think you really disagree with, and try to understand why they are persuasive to other people. It's not a bold or new idea, but it's still, I think that's much harder for people to do.
Yeah. Well, this was awesome.
Happy 2024,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. Happy 2024. May we live to see 2025.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.